Good morning. I'm Scott Boersma, conference chair, if you haven't guessed. I'm very pleased to have all of you here. And I'm honored to be introducing Steve McKay. He last year at conference volunteered to come speak, and I hadn't met him previously. And as I've visited with him and been on his website, he's got some really wonderful food Aronia products to try. And unfortunately, I didn't get around to begging him and getting samples. I wanted to sample everything he creates, Steve. I really did. But anyway, he's going to be here until about 2 o'clock today. He's going to visit and speak here for about an hour, and then we're going to end it. And we have vendor time, but if he's willing to stick around and answer a few more questions during that time if you want. So Steve's been in the fruit industry for 40 years. He's a retired extension educator. He's worked in California, Costa Rica, and currently in New York. And he's one of the key people that brought Aronia back to the United States. So you can either thank him or blame him for your problems. So thanks, Steve.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I feel privileged to be following with the comments that John and Colleen made regarding the development of the co-op, because I think that it's a very, very important effort, and I really appreciated seeing the perspective that they had as to where the industry is at, where the industry can go. I tend to be a hands-on type of a person. I like to get in there and do it. And so I'm going to give you some of that get in there and do it type of stuff today, because even though we're at that point where they say there are hardly any Aronia berries around, if you're sitting on 1,000 pounds, 5,000 pounds, 10,000 pounds of Aronia and wondering what to do with it, it might be nice to have a solution or some way that you can find your way out yourselves to do something locally. And to keep in mind that anything that you're doing locally can help to develop what the national effort is with the cooperative effort. And so I want to keep that in mind, that even though the big emphasis that I'm going to have today is on these local processing plants that you can develop, that it would be nice if those could all be in connection and working in harmony and concert with the concept of the overall co-op. Okay, so let me get my pointer here and we'll get started. So as I said yesterday, these are some of the questions we're going to try to answer today. Because I want to give you guys some education and background as to what is processing and what happens in processing, because a lot of people are afraid of it and really shouldn't be, because once you understand some basic principles, most anybody can do it. And what are some of the packaging options that exist for the products that you can make? What does some of the equipment look like? You may think that you need to have a special college degree in order to operate the equipment. That's not true either. What kinds of building would you need and in order to house some kind of a processing plant? And what are some of the legal things that are behind doing processing? And what I want to do first of all to start out is to tell you what traditional juicing looks like in a larger scale processing plant, and then come back down to the level that we're talking about with smaller scale. I had the opportunity to visit Beecham's plant in England to see how it is that they made Ribena and how it is that they worked with black currants. And it's a similar process that would be used for processing black currants. And so I'm going to share some of those steps in the processing and what some of that equipment looks like, and as to why it is that you, as smaller growers, wouldn't probably want to touch that, but then give you the alternative as to what you can touch and still come up with something that's really good. So what are the steps that are involved in traditional juicing? First of all, you'll take the fruit out of the freezer. The freezing and thawing helps to break down the cell walls of the fruit, and then you heat treat that with pectinase, which breaks down the cell walls and releases the color that's in the fruit and makes it juiceable. The fruit can then be ground and then squeezed under pressure. And then the juice is generally separated from its aromatics. The aromatics are the chemicals that it has inside of it that naturally give it its flavor. The problem is that from year to year, the flavor of berries changes. And if you're trying to sell a product that is consistent from year to year and the taste of the product is changing from year to year, your customers might start to complain. And for instance, in the case of Beecham's, they have a panel of 20 people who are specialized in tasting, and they take all of the flavor out of the juice and then they put it back in to try to blend it so that each year that it has the same flavor. And so as you begin growing your fruit, you're going to be seeing those differences and wonder, how is it that you can deal with those differences? Well, that's how they do it on a larger scale. And so after they've gone through that process of the juicing, then you have the option that you can concentrate the juice and reblend the aromatics so that it comes out to be the flavor that you want it. And then even you could take it a step further and freeze dry it so that it would be the kind of crystals that you would use to just mix water into and then still have a juice that would come out of it. So the different kinds of products that could come from large-scale processing, and these were probably some of the toll processors like Colleen was talking about and John was talking about, would be things like juice and juice blends, syrup, flavorings, natural food coloring, concentrated syrup, and freeze-dried powders and fruit that could be used as culinary ingredients, things that you would use to make your salad dressings, your jam, your jellies, and those kinds of things. Interestingly enough, when I first came to work at Co-op Extension, Wildwood was making an Aronia product that was on the market for a few years, and they were selling it to Costco out on the West Coast. We on the East Coast, nobody knew about what Aronia was because it wasn't ever marketed or sold there. But it was kind of one of those punchy types of juices that had 10% juice in it, and all the rest was high fructose corn syrup and water. And probably didn't need food coloring because that's one of the real benefits of our crop is that it has plenty of color. And in fact, that's one of the main uses for Aronia right now is in food coloring. So this is what some of the equipment that looks like on probably more like a medium-sized scale plant because larger size is scaled up a whole lot larger than this. But you have your processing tank here where you would take and heat the fruit with the pectinase. Then it would be put through some kind of a juicer that would squeeze the juice out, and then concentrating type of equipment is there. This thing that looks like a still actually is a still, and that's the thing that separates out the flavor components. And this is a piece of equipment that's a freeze dryer. So you can have kind of a visual as to what those things look like. And as I mentioned yesterday, I'm going to all of these pictures are going to be available to you through the association, through this talk. Also, when you start getting into filling, it becomes a much more complicated process with equipment that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. This right here is a traditional type of a filler that automatically fills up bottles and normally screws on the has a cap screw that screws on the caps. In the case of plastic, PET plastic, PET plastic is the clear plastic that you get a lot of your juice drinks in, is done in a very clean environment, and in fact the whole system is enclosed. And Tetra Pak is another that has a similar type of a closed system. When you're talking Tetra Pak systems, you're talking millions of dollars. So anyway, these are things that are out of our reach as small-scale types of growers and producers, but I wanted you just to be aware of what that industry looked like. Packaging, these are Tetra Paks at the top. They also have a box with a plastic liner for used for fountain service or in food service. Also, you can package in barrels with aseptic liners, in glass of all different forms, and in plastic. And probably as small-scale producers, we're going to be packaging in glass, or in plastic. The process that we're going to be using in order to have a shelf-stable process is to do what we call hot packing, where you heat the temperature of the juice up high enough so that if you invert the bottle, the heat of the juice will actually kill the microorganisms that are around the cap. And so that's the basic process. Everything is in need of being pasteurized nowadays because of the problems with E. coli and other foodborne microorganisms. And this type of container is used traditionally for ciders. And there's a process of flash pasteurizing where you can heat the temperature up and cool it back down again. At least you've killed the microorganisms that might cause damage to a person's body. But still, it's not a shelf-stable product. There are some cases where you can heat this plastic high enough to around 180 degrees if you've got a small enough container with thick enough sides that you can still get some shelf stability out of it and get anywhere from 3 to 6 months of life out of that product, which can be beneficial for your marketing. But PET glass or PET plastic, this type of thing can be heated up to around 190 degrees maximum. And normally your bottling temperature would be somewhere around 180 or 185 degrees, so it can handle that. It has these little dents all over it because that allows for expansion and contraction, because that's the problem with packaging in plastic, is that when you put something hot in it, you can imagine that it's expanded big, and as it cools down, it's going to contract. And so to take up that expansion and contraction, they've got all of these little nooks and crannies built into the bottle so that that happens. With glass, of course, that isn't a problem because the glass is stable. The other thing that I've found with about 5 or 6 years of packaging in glass is that the glass seems to be a lot more stable than plastic. The product holds up better. It doesn't tend to breathe, and there just seems to be a way that the plastic loses flavor and loses quality faster than glass does. But plastic has the advantage of shipability, and so when you're moving and it also doesn't break as easily. So when you're moving things around, that's an advantage of using plastic over using glass. But when you're looking at an upper end, higher end type of market, a lot of people like glass, and glass is recyclable, and so that's another advantage. So you just have to weigh all of these advantages and disadvantages that you have when you decide which kind of packaging you're going to want to use. So when we talk in terms of small scale food processing, food safety is the first issue that comes to most people's minds. And I just wanted to make two important points with that. First of all, probably everybody here who's a grower has heard of GAPS, Good Agricultural Practices. And if you can come up with a GAPS plan, then what you're going to ensure is that you have a safe product that's not going to be contaminated with chemicals and with microbes of some kind. And so that's your first line of defense, is to come in with a clean product that doesn't have chemical contamination or microbial contamination. At the same time, when you're working with fruit on a small scale, and because a lot of us as local people like to keep things raw and that kind of thing, that there should be some kind of a treatment, at least on the outside of the fruit, in order to avoid microbial issues. Because you always are going to have birds and other animals that could contaminate that product while it's out in the field and while it's growing. Obviously, it's nature. And being myself on the older side, I remember times when we didn't even worry about that, and we always felt, well, if you ate a little bit more bacteria, that would make you healthier because you'd be more resistant to it. But I think what's happened over the years is that people have discovered that a lot of these things that we just kind of took for granted, or if we got a slight case of diarrhea, people didn't worry about it. Now people are more concerned about it. And so basically the two ways to easily deal with the microbial question are sanitation with chlorine bleach solutions And it's amazing how dilute those bleach solutions can be and still be effective in the 100 to 200 parts per million range. Also, pasteurization, if you get temperatures up to 180 degrees, these two processes will help make it so you won't have to worry about microbial contamination. Okay. It's a good thing, regulation sometimes, because it can help to keep our food safe and help to keep us safe and healthy. And that's why it is that we have all of these licensing and all of this paperwork that we have to deal with. State licenses are normally given for a food processing facility, and these are oftentimes inspected at the same time by the state inspector for the FDA. They do kind of a dual type of an inspection. However, at times, you have to, if you have a facility, you do have to register it with the FDA, and you will have sometimes an FDA inspector just show up. And, they keep talking about how it's going to become more and more regulated, and that becomes more and more scary. And you have these pictures of inspectors coming around and taking cotton swabs and swabbing the fans in your coolers, swabbing the floor drains, swabbing the walls, and all trying to find these pathogenic bacteria that can cause foodborne illness. And so if they find it, then you have to deal with it. But by keeping your place clean and with regular sanitation with chlorine, bleach types of mixes, and if you know what you're doing and you have an easily cleanable facility, it doesn't really have to be a problem. But it's, they're after those places that are dirty and are causing a problem. And then we already mentioned GAPS. There's another system which is called HACCP, which is the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point Plan. And what you do is you take a look at the process of processing a fruit. For instance, if you're going to sell the fresh fruit on the market, you might look at what are the steps in order to get the fruit from the field and into the basket and into the store. And you look at what points along the way you could possibly have contamination, and then how does it you can control the possible contamination to avoid it, and then how you can regularly monitor it to make sure that there's no contamination happening. So it sounds complicated, but really it's really basic and really logical, just like GAPS are. But what you have to do is you have to just take a detailed look at your facility and what is it you're doing to make sure you're doing things right and not having a point of entry for some kind of contamination. Traceability is also a requirement. We have to know where the raw products came from, the source, and batch numbers and that kind of thing. And then we also have to have developed a schedule process, which is a university-approved method of doing the processing so that it is not going to present a hazard, a food hazard, okay, a safety hazard. And so we have, in the traceability process, we have to see where things came from. We have to see that you followed the schedule process. And then we also have to see where it is that everything went, just in case there might be a recall, that you would know where to go in order to recall those products back. So here again is a little bit more detail about that traceability. Another thing is what are critical factors? Okay, critical factors are an important part of a schedule process. It's kind of like those critical points along the HACCP plan, but this is focused in on your food processing plan. And so we need to see what it is that you're doing in order to control microbes, basically. And there are basically a few different ways that we can control microbes. We can control microbes by heating. And so figuring out what temperature you have to heat to and hold in order to destroy microorganisms to the point that's necessary to have safe food can be one important point. We have degrees, bricks, or soluble solids, which basically boils down to sugar content. So sweetening something is another way to slow down microbial growth. Acidity, or pH, is another way. And anything that is pH 3.8 or lower is generally considered safer, and anything that is higher than 3.8 is considered low acid and requires a little bit more care as far as heating, because if anything is 3.8 or lower, the acid tends to hold down microbial growth. Water activity is another consideration. If you're doing a dried product, there are certain standards as to how dry a product has to be so that it will prevent the growth of mold and fungus. Another question that could come up in a critical factor is inversion times for hot pack treatment. When you're doing home bottling or small-scale bottling and hot packing, you have to invert the bottles for usually around 2 to 5 minutes in order to destroy the bacteria that are or fungus that could be possibly contaminating the top of the container. So when they make a schedule process, what it does is it talks about how many ounces or pounds of a product that you use and how you combine them together. But along the way, when you're going through the process, it's got a special little compartment there where it talks about these critical points along the process, like the minimum amount of heat, the minimum amount of acidity. And if something's not acid enough, you can add citric acid or ascorbic acid to acidify it. You can add more sugar if you needed to raise the degrees bricks. So there are various things you can do, and the university would help you with the plans for the product that you have in order to make it safe according to those critical factors in the schedule process. Okay. Why is it that I like some of these small-scale processing methods that I'm using? First of all, when we talk about the infusion process, there's no waste in the product that we make, because basically you take and you dump berries into a steam kettle and you heat them up with some syrup, you strain out the berries, and you have the product that you guys got to taste yesterday, the dried fruit, and then on the other hand you have the syrup. The syrup can be turned into something, and the dried berries can be turned into something. So you're not pressing and throwing away a pomace that is a certain percentage that you're losing in the process. And so since we're small processors at this point, and you might only have 1,000 pounds or 5,000 pounds of product, you want to make full use of every pound of that fruit that you got. And this is a way that you can keep that fruit all there without losing anything. And so that's pretty nice. If you're going to be doing pulping with a pulping machine, the pomace that comes from that pulper, assuming that you've put a clean product in, could be used to make dried and make tea. Okay. So the other advantage of the small-scale processing is you're going to find that they require pulping and infusion require a relatively small investment in order to produce a versatile primary process product that can be used to make literally hundreds of different products that you could sell on a local basis. Then as you begin to get fancy and you start making money on your simpler products, you can begin to invest in other machines that will add further value to the product and develop additional retail products for local marketing. And another big advantage is that all of this equipment that we're going to talk about could be used for processing red currants, black currants, gooseberries, raspberries, blueberries. And so you name it, you choose it. If you want to make full good economic use of your equipment, it's there. And it's versatile to be able to use with these same processes for all of these same fruits. So you have a lot of possibilities. Okay, the first thing I'm going to talk about is pulping. And this is what a pulping machine looks like in simple design. Like I say, within a couple of months, we should be releasing a photograph of the pulping machine that we're making in Guatemala that's an improvement over this. But basically, I can't move it. But anyway, the fruit goes in through the top here, and then there's a rotating drum inside there, blades inside of a drum that has screen on it. And what it does is it scrapes the fruit over the screen and forces the pulp to go out. But the holes in the screen are small enough so that the seeds and the other foreign matter are passed through a different part of the machine. So one portion of the product, the pomace, goes off one side, and then the pulp comes out the other, and it's separated. So then the pulp could be used for things like we say, like jam and smoothies, yogurt, sorbetto, ice cream, fruit leather, gels. It's all ready to use, okay? And also, if you're not ready to use the product right away, there are two ways to store it. One way is to heat treat it to 180 degrees and put it into 5-gallon plastic buckets, seal the buckets, and that way you don't have to invest in paying monthly storage rates in a freezer. Okay, it's a slightly different product, but at least you've got something that you don't have to pay an energy cost on. Or if you want the fresh product, you can use it frozen. Again, though, if you're passing raw material through here, it's important to heat the product just to the point to at least pasteurize it so that you don't have problem with contamination from the field. So again, remember that. Bleach, water, treatment, or heating to keep the food safe. Okay, here's the other one that is my biggest baby, the infusion process. And what you need to do is to start with your raw material that hopefully has, if you can't do it through like a destemming machine, you could do it, if worse came to worse, on tables by hand. And that's actually how we're sorting our 5,000 pounds of aronia this year is by hand. To take the leaves and stems and snails and grasshoppers and anything else that happened to land in there when we put that fruit into pails and put it into the freezer. So we're storing our aronia berries in 5-gallon pails right now, frozen and ready to pull out its loose fruit, thank goodness, because it wasn't wet. And so it's easier to just pour it out on a tray and then to separate that other stuff out, and then you take the fruit and you can use it either in the pulp or in the infusion process. So anyway, once you've gotten the fruit relatively cleaned, you're going to heat it up in the steam kettle in a fruit syrup. And my favorite fruit syrup is deionized grape juice concentrate. But there are various other types of syrups that you could use. And in fact, some people who don't want to invest the money on syrup do it in sugar water. So whatever your choice is, in order to do the infusion, what happens is that you soften your fruit and you sweeten it, and it loses some of the astringency so that it becomes palatable, just like that fruit that you ate the other day. The fruit is then strained out of the syrup where it can be used as the raisins if you dry it, or it can be used as wet fruit. And the syrup is stored either frozen or heated for shelf stabilization and then stored. And so the products you can make would include things like syrup, or if you add 3 parts of water to that syrup, you all of a sudden have aronia juice, voila, and it's really good tasting. You can use seltzer water to have a sparkling juice, and you can also use it in your ice cream. I like to mix 1/4 of this fruit syrup with 3/4 ice cream mix, and it comes out to have a perfect flavor and a perfect texture. And then you can mix in, like I say, some of the wet aronia berries to give it texture and some, just be creative, some chocolate chips if you wanted to, some almonds, whatever you like. And then the same way with the sorbetto, good natural product. So in order to have a visual of what it is that it looks like in this process, you got your steam kettle, and then you just simply use a strainer to pull the berries out of the syrup, because the berries were here all mixed together with the syrup. And then we put them in these settling strainers so that the juice can settle out of them. And the good thing is that aronia berries don't hold back much juice, and within about an hour they're drained off, so you can dump that syrup back into the syrup and dump your fruit off to either freeze it or dry it, however you want to. And this is how I dry it, in a convection oven on trays on stainless steel screen. The stainless steel screen is not cheap, of course. You could easily go downtown and buy galvanized hardware cloth, but remember that wouldn't be legal, and that's not also healthy because you could be contaminating with zinc and other metals, you know. So you want to do a product that's safe for your customers, so you want to make that investment in what you have to and get the proper stainless steel. The wet fruit, if you didn't want to dry, could either be frozen or it could be heated to become shelf-stable and stored in jars or whatever. If you decide you want to take it a step further and make, like, chocolate-covered raisins, this is the equipment that you would use. You'd have a chocolate melter that would melt a chocolate coverture, and this machine that looks like a cement mixer that goes round and round. You just dump chocolate in on top of the raisins that are in there, and they coat themselves. And obviously there's some tricks of the trade, but this is the basic of it, you know. And so if you have a good professor like me to help you do it, you'll find that it's something that's very, very doable. Then if you want to get even more sophisticated, you can get into making things like yogurt and ice cream, and you get into a lot more expensive equipment. And just so that you can see what this equipment is, I'm going to be giving you a financial breakdown of all this stuff here in just a minute. But in order to do your own ice cream mix, you have to have a pasteurizer, and this is a JB pasteurizer, which is quite commonly used for small scale. Has a capacity of 30 gallons at a time. The minimum amount that you can produce in there is 15 gallons, so you have to at least do a batch of 15 gallons, but you can get up into 30. It's required, and this is going to make a lot of you laugh, you have to pasteurize milk. So even if you buy pasteurized milk from your dairy already in those bags, you have to dump it in and you have to repasteurize it again. And in the state of New York, I don't know if it's the same way, because I think it's every state has their own regulation, but I asked the folks at the state of New York, why is it I have to pasteurize milk if it's already safe? And they said, there is no scientific reason, it's just a rule, you have to do it. So I do it. And then the other thing is that makes this system expensive is that you have to have a recording thermometer that is a graph, and you have to record the thermometer of the air temperature above the milk or the mix, and also the temperature of the mix to make sure that the pasteurization is complete. Okay, once then you get to the point that you want to make ice cream or sorbetto, then you get into batch freezers. This is a small batch, 3-gallon batch freezer that's air-dried, or air-cooled, excuse me. This one is 5-gallon capacity, which is water-cooled. And then when you want to get into continuous production, in these batch freezers, you have to do it batch by batch by batch. Then when you get into continuous, you can get into a machine like this that has tanks that you keep dumping mix into, and it keeps cranking out the the product. So it all depends on what scale that you want to work at. So what are the considerations then when you are selecting a plant site? And this is, first of all, the site where you might construct something, or if you're looking at a building, what do you want to consider about its surroundings? First of all, you want to have a good source of water and a source of water disposal. You want to be away from filth in an unkempt environment, because that's one of the things that the inspectors will check when they come to look you over. You want to be accessible from roads and have parking and loading capabilities. Source of energy, gas, electric, at least have 220 single phase, and if possible, three phase, 220, because a lot of the equipment that's available is three phase in order to conserve energy. I don't happen to have three phase. It goes to my place, so I had to buy a three phase generator to generate my own three phase from single phase 220, which is a little bit more costly than if I were to have the actual three phase, but it would have cost a whole lot more to have the electric company run that third electrical wire in. Have communications, cable or telephone, and be near a source of fruit and as near to your source of market as possible. So these are just all considerations. The building itself needs to be a building that you can easily keep pests out of. If you've got a kind of building that's got little holes where rats or mice can come in, that's a problem. And you also need to develop a pest control plan. How is it you're going to control flies or anything else that might potentially be a pest in your area? Easily cleanable walls and floors, and that's normally there are plastic panels that they sell. They cost about $30 a piece for an 4x8 piece of this paneling to cover the walls with. And then on the floors, if you have a cement floor, I have an epoxy-based floor, which is really, really great. It was $10,000 to put the stupid floor in, but I figured if I was going to have something permanent, it would be good, because I tried using those paints that you paint on concrete, and I found that it chipped off and chipped off and chipped off, so and it had to be constantly maintained, and I was always afraid the paint was going to get into my product. So I think it's worth it to do a good job with the floor and either put some kind of a tile covering. The problem with tiles is that grout and tiles do break and wear down. This epoxy is something that's going to last basically for the rest of our lifetime and not need a whole lot of maintenance. It's very easy to clean. Floor drains so that you can hose things down. If you're making a building from scratch or you need to pour a new floor in there, make sure that you insist that your contractor plans that floor so that you have good drainage into those drains. Drains need to be properly maintained also in a food facility and regularly sanitized, because that's the first place where these FDA inspectors are going to go and try to find contamination and say, ah, it's there. And, well, how did it get up? Well, it might have splashed up into the food or whatever. But anyway, floor drains are an important consideration. Storage space is also critical. Outbuildings, as well as what you have inside, you know, for the things that you're going to be using on a real regular basis. And try to plan your building so that you've got the equipment with kind of a flow plan for production, for the incoming raw product, the actual process, and then what goes out the other end. Handicapped access is a consideration. I had to build a big ramp and a big handicapped bathroom in my facility in the middle, and it took up a big part of my kitchen. So depending on what your regulations are, that was interesting. I don't, you know, anyway, whatever. Also, for dairy, if you're going to be doing any kind of dairy processing, you have to have a double door entry, especially if you have a restroom or another outside door in order to get into the dairy processing area. And another obvious, I think obvious given is both hot and cold running water. Okay, so this gets down to the question of how much is this going to cost me? And this is, I think, kind of the exciting part, you know, because when you really look at it and you look at how much you can produce with this small investment here, I think it's pretty impressive. But these prices are not based on new prices, okay? These are based on used prices, because you're going to find that you can pick up a lot of this equipment on eBay, of all places. I shipped in one of my steam kettles from Florida up into New York State. I bought it for $800. It cost me $200 worth of shipping, and it was, $300 to have it fitted to propane and to make it work right. And that would have cost me, if I would have bought it new, somewhere around $15,000 or $20,000. So what's one going to do when they're starting? You know, what makes sense? I bought one of my batch freezers in California and had it shipped all across the U.S. I bought it for, again, $1,000. That batch freezer was, I had to retrofit the inside because it turned out that it was kind of not in real good shape. But with $2,000 worth of work, $1,000 equipment, piece of equipment, $500 worth of shipping, I had a $10,000 to $15,000 piece of equipment working. So you see, with a little bit of running around and a little bit of sourcing, thank goodness we've got the internet, because that really helps. And also, if you've got places where auctions are going on or used equipment supply places, you can kind of pick these things up if you know what to look for. Same way with the convection ovens. I bought those from all over the country. The three that I have, they came in from out of state. Even stainless steel buckets I bought online because they weren't readily available in my community. So anyway, when you look at this whole list, you know, you can see that for about $10,000 worth of equipment, you're up and running. And I think that's pretty impressive. So what kind of a capacity does a plant like that have? I'm going to assume that you know, and there are many different scenarios, and this could vary according to how you want to do it and how you work it. But if you assume that you have a 75-gallon steam kettle and three convection ovens, and you want to make raisins and syrup, you could take 300 pounds of fruit and steep it in syrup for about 12 hours in the kettle to produce about 30 gallons of syrup, which would make about 120 to 150 gallons of juice, which you could package in 8-ounce or 12-ounce or 16-ounce or possibly even half gallons to sell, according to if you're selling them at farmers markets or into your local food store chains, whatever it was that they wanted. And about 2 to 4 hours worth of drying time with three ovens, you would have those 100 pounds of dried. Okay, I didn't even put the amount of pounds. Within 2 to 4 hours of drying time, you'd have about 100 pounds of dried fruit, okay, out of that whole thing. 100 pounds of dried fruit, 30 gallons of syrup. So I figured out how long it would take to process, a ton of fruit. 1 to 2 tons of fruits in this little kitchen then could be processed each week with just simply one steam kettle. So those of you who are starting out with these small amounts that any of these toll processors like Colleen was talking about that would laugh at you if you said you wanted to take, 1,000 pounds, 2,000 pounds or whatever, if you get a group of you together, the maybe 5 or 6 growers and wanted to get into doing this process, you could see that over the winter time and through the spring, you could be processing. You still have plenty of capacity even to pick up other fruits and to do other projects besides the aronia berries. So it makes it something that worthwhile looking at. Now, if you begin to look at optional additional equipment, the price begins to go up. And so these are some of the prices that you can look at for chocolate panner, chocolate enrober, chocolate temperer. All of these things I personally have accumulated over the years, but I just wanted to give you an idea as to what those costs were. The only thing I still don't have is a bottler, because we do all of our bottling by hand. And you may ask, well, how is it that you bottle the juice? Because I don't have one of those fancy bottlers that start at price $20,000 up into hundreds of thousand dollars. I had two custom tanks that were built in New York City, stainless steel, that we just do it bottle by bottle by bottle by bottle. But it's amazing how fast it goes once you start doing it. That was an $800 investment for those two tanks. So just so you have an idea. What do you think? You think it's possible? So in my opinion, there's our solution for what can take care of us until we're up to the point where we have these huge volumes of aronia berry that really can go mainstream. This gives us time to develop the products like I was talking about yesterday that could become mainstream products that the co-op could be focusing on. The co-op could coordinate a number of different small processors to maintain quality, to maintain a certain set of products, and to begin getting that stuff slowly but surely out into the market.
Okay, we got time for a couple quick questions. If you have one, raise your hand. I'll bring a mic to you. And then we'll have vendor time, and we'll get back on schedule at 11 o'clock. So.
Now, our berry is the highest ORAC value berry out there, and there's so many other help, the enzymes and the bacteria of the berry and all that. By pasteurization and the other processes, how much of our berry are we going to be losing by going through this process that you just described?
Again, that's something that more research would be nice to finally put the final, word on. But research that's been done in Europe about antioxidants and these anthocyanins and things that we're talking about that give our product the qualities that it have show that this amount of heating doesn't have an extreme effect. Something like vitamin C, yes, it would affect. And what we do, in fact, when we make our black currant juice in my factory is at the very end we throw in some extra ascorbic acid just to bring that vitamin C content back up again. But the other antioxidants that are in there, they've actually shown that on some of them are actually accentuated by heating. So it just depends on what it is. I can't give you the exact details of that, but there are articles about that are out there, published.
We got one question here from Roberta Barham. She's on the ballot for this afternoon as a potential board member.
So after you bottle the juices, then you can them or seal them? Do you heat them again?
No. What we're doing is we're doing a hot pack process. And as long as you heat them up to 180 degrees and invert them, they're safe and they're shelf stable.
All right, sounds good. Steve will be around for a few questions afterwards while the rest of you are out with vendors. So thank you, Steve.
Thank you.